features of a ma'ida that need to be observed. And some of them are necessary, some of them are sunnah, some of them are recommended. You know, but when he's mentioning all of these things, he says, for example, the necessary thing is for you to be content with what you have, for you to say Bismillah, for you to be thankful. And then for the sunnah, for you to make sure that you do wudu before you eat, for you to sit down on your left side, for to lean more, incline yourself more to the left side, for you to eat with three fingers. You know that it's mustahab to eat with your hands in Islam, with your fingers, not hands, sorry, with your fingers in Islam. And if when you finish eating with your fingers, that you lick your fingers. These are all ways of you appreciating what it is that you have and being thankful. You remember what I said as far as kufrun ni'mah, for a person to reject and deny and be unappreciative of God's blessings, especially when it comes to gluttony, especially when it comes to being so obsessed with food, especially when it comes to overpouring food and then not even eating it, and the waste and the israf and all these other things, or maybe luxurious kind of foods. A person spends a lot of money for what? For their stomach. Imam Ali alayhi salam says that if your only concern is that which goes into your stomach, then your value is that which comes out of your stomach. Eating with your fingers, with your three fingers, licking the fingers after you have eaten with them. And as for the adab, eat that which is in front of you. Make sure you eat small morsels of food. Make sure you chew. Tajweedul madgh. Tajweed means make sure you madgh, you chew in the best way possible. وَقِلَّةُ النَّظَرِ فِي وُجُوهِ النَّاسِ. And don't look at the other people while you are eating. You know, there are many other things that we can mention as far as eating is concerned. Like, you know, we haven't mentioned that it is not good for you to talk while you are eating. A lot of people choke, you know, while they are eating, you know, because they laugh or because they said something or anything else. It's makruh to talk, have a conversation while you are eating. Eating is for that alone, and you do it and you avoid anything else that would bring about anything negative or bad.
Ayatollah Javadi Omri, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Again, the main point in all of this is to understand that we need to appreciate the ni'mas of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala when it comes to food, when it comes to how we are able to have that spiritual health through 18. And here the important point in this episode is the social side of eating, that we should remember that we eat not alone, but eat with others. A hadith, I just forgot which imam it was from, that says, al-it'amu sadaqa. So it's a form of charity giving, you know. Even though the person might not be a poor person, but you feeding someone, you participating in a meal with someone, you breaking bread with someone else is a very, very important sunnah. Maybe that person might not even be a Muslim, but you're breaking bread with them and you're eating with them. And there's a beautiful hadith from that is mentioned from Nabiullah Ibrahim alayhi salam, where Ibrahim, and the story goes very, very quickly, the story goes that Ibrahim was so much accustomed, like all the other a'immah and anbiya, so much accustomed to always eating with somebody. And then one day, he walked out to the outskirts looking for someone to eat with him. And then finally someone came, and he realized while he was going to give the food, he realized that this person was not from among the believers. And Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam said, well, you know, seeing that you're not from among the believers, you know, I'm not going to be comfortable continuing on in this meal with you until you, you know, say, you know, for example, in the name of God, or thank God for the sustenance that has been given to us. And then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala revealed unto Ibrahim salamullahi alayhi that your means are provided by me, and his means are also provided by me. And the means I provided to him was through you. So how could you reject that? So this is, you know, one of many, many different kind of examples of how, even though the other person might be someone you are not in favor of, someone who might not even be a believer in any religion, but yet it's still going to be something good for you to break, as they say, break bread with them. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام المؤمن أصلب من الجبل الجبل يستقل منه والمؤمن لا يستقل من دينه شيء.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The believer is harder than a mountain, for the mountain is dispensable, whereas nothing can separate the believer from his religion."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the very interesting dialogues and conversations in the historical texts of the Muslims a dialogue between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and Zurara. Zurara was one of the very famous companions of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. He was very well respected by Imam al-Baqir, and he was very well respected by Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam as well. Now, in this conversation between Zurara and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, we find that Zurara asked Imam al-Baqir, "What is the meaning of al-Hanafiyya?" Now, here, Hanafi, of course, what is meant is not the Sunni sect of Islam. But rather, when we talk about Prophet Ibrahim, or we talk about the prophets after Prophet Isa, Prophet Jesus, all the way up to Prophet Muhammad, there is this time in between which is called that the people followed the Hanaf religion or the Hanafi religion, right? And so they're called that they were on the path of Hanaf. So, for example, the parents of the Holy Prophet, or the great-grandparents of the Holy Prophet, and so on and so forth. They were the Hanafi deen, the deen ul-Hanif. Prophet Ibrahim is said to be on this deen ul-Hanif, the religion of Hanif. So Zurara asks Imam al-Baqir, "What is the meaning of this al-Hanif or al-Hanafiyya?" Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam replies in this conversation that it is the nature Allah has created in human beings. Allah has created this Hanafi in human beings so that they can recognize Allah. So this Hanafi religion, dear friends, is meant to be Islam. It is that nature which Allah has created in human beings, in every single human being, which allows and really makes aware a human being in order to recognize Allah. And so it is this Hanif religion which the great-grandparents and the grandparents of the Holy Prophet were on, this innate perfection within every human being, which allows them to recognize that Allah exists. There is a God. A very beautiful conversation, a very deep and profound conversation, speaking about a concept which is very seldomly spoken about, the Hanif religion. This innate nature, this fitrah that every human being has, which pulls them towards Allah, which helps them recognize Allah, which tells them that there is Allah. Very beautiful words exchanged in this dialogue between Zarara and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When we remember our fifth Imam, we remember an important part of the recommendations of the fifth Imam, which I would like to narrate for you in this regard, which he gave to his famous companion, Jabir Ju'fi. He told him, the fifth Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, to him, I'm going to give you tips, Imam al-Baqir says, things, remember them. Imam alayhi salam says, وَإِنْ خَانُوكَ فَلَا تَخُنْ. If you're betrayed, if you're stabbed in the back, then you don't stab in the back. Do you see why? The Imam alayhi salam is saying, as a follower of the Ahl al-Bayt, we can't use the excuse, well, they did it, I have to also. Does it look good for me? If I don't respond in the same way, it looks weak on me. Imam alayhi salam says, it is not about what people will say, it's about how you be judged by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, if you are the subject of betrayal, do not yourself betray. If they dismiss you and they say you are a liar, yes, and they constantly disbelieve in what you say, don't get angry. Don't lose your cool. Imam al-Baqir, Imam al-Sadiq, when they were debating these people, the atheists and the agnostics, did they lose their cool? Sometimes, yes, they would sit with them. Okay, you don't want to believe? No problem. It's up to you. وَإِن مُدِحْتَ فَلَا تَفْرَحْ. When you are praised, never be happy. Don't think that when people praise you, don't let it get to you. Don't make it as a sense to boast your ego and your desire for yourself. وَإِن ذُمِمْتَ فَلَا تَجْزَعْ. When you are criticized, don't give up. When you are told, for example, you're not doing a good job, continue. Improve yourself.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Yemen has recently been the scene of deadly clashes between Ansarullah fighters and forces loyal to the former president Abu Rabah Mansur Hadi, who aimed to capture the strategic northern city of Ma'arib. The fighting left at least 60 people dead on both sides Saturday. This after army forces and allied fighters continued with their push towards the oil-rich city, Hadi's last urban stronghold in Yemen, which is some 120 kilometers east of the capital Sana'a. Reports said that a high-ranking pro-Hadi military commander from Ma'arib's provincial military police also got killed. But last Friday was the bloodiest day since the start of the offensive on February 8. More than 60 people died in that fighting. Reports said the dead included at least 27 pro-Hadi militias. Meanwhile, on Saturday, several civilians, including a child, got killed in a Saudi-led airstrike in Yemen's western province of Hodeidah. The Yemeni media said that a drone raid targeted a residential building in the city of Hodeidah, also injuring several others.
The war being waged by the Saudi royal family against the people of Yemen, which is the poorest country in the Arab world, is an illegal war. It's a war of aggression, and it's also illegal in the targets that it takes in Yemen. 233,000 people are reported to have been killed. These are civilians who have been killed by Saudi air attacks. And a child dies every 10 minutes, according to UNICEF, in Yemen due to hunger and to lack of medications. And that's because the Saudis are illegally blocking aid coming into the port of Hodeidah. So everything about this war is illegal.
The attack comes as the sixth anniversary of the Saudi invasion of Yemen is near. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions. It has also reduced to rubble much of Yemen's infrastructure. The United Nations has described the situation as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN's humanitarian agency has warned that more than 16 million people in Yemen will go hungry this year as Saudi Arabia presses ahead with this notorious war. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said that 500,000 Yemenis are already living in famine-like conditions. They said the risk of large-scale famine has never been more acute than now. According to the agency, years of conflict have created enormous humanitarian needs in all sectors.
The famine caused by the Saudi war on Yemen is part of the illegality of the war in general. It's been caused because the Saudis have been blockading the ports of Yemen, especially Hodeidah, and preventing international aid from coming in, aid that has been mandated through the United Nations and agreed to by the parties at international conferences. But that doesn't stop the Saudi coalition from trying to starve the people of Yemen into submission.
The UN says that at least 60% of Yemenis are food insecure, and 16 million people do not have access to safe water and proper sanitation. The war impact, compounded by the blockade and the coronavirus pandemic, has battered Yemenis. But all of this would not have happened from the beginning if the U.S. and its allies had not provided logistical military support and military hardware to Saudi Arabia.
It's shameful that the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France, Italy, and other countries have been selling large amounts of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the UAE. These arms have allowed the Saudi coalition to wage this illegal war on the people of Yemen and to cause widespread death and famine.
The Biden administration says it plans to stop arms sales to the Saudis and to stop supporting their war in Yemen. Many would consider this move as too little too late, because Riyadh has already packed its arsenal with huge quantities of arms that it bought from the previous administration and other Western governments, especially the UK. But almost 6 years into the war, the Saudis are facing an impasse, as they have not made any significant gains on the battlefield. They have suffered many humiliating blows from the Yemenis who, unlike their enemy, have stood their ground. The latest attack on Riyadh is one example. What the people of Yemen want to see at a minimum is a meaningful move by the West and the UN to effectively end this war that will go down in history as a war in which the U.S. backed the Saudi-led coalition and committed war crimes in that country.
the world will never forget the gruesome assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The outspoken critic of the Saudi regime was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Shortly after the killing, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessed with high confidence that Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had personally ordered the assassination. The case turned into a severe political storm, triggering global condemnation of the Saudis. However, then U.S. President Donald Trump chose to stand with the notorious Crown Prince and rejected calls to condemn him. Trump's White House dismissed intelligence that bin Salman personally ordered the killing. The former American president made no secret of what was behind his unrelenting support for bin Salman. Trump stressed that he did not want to sacrifice billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the matter. The previous U.S. administration blocked the release of the intelligence community's findings into the killing. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, is apparently taking a different course. Biden said during a presidential campaign rally that Khashoggi was murdered and that he believes the Crown Prince ordered the hit. His administration is now releasing a declassified version of a top-secret intelligence report that singles out the Saudi Crown Prince for at least giving the go-ahead for the assassination, if not directly ordering it. Biden has pledged to take a tough line on Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and its war on Yemen.
Biden, I think, is signaling MBS and the world that the United States is getting back on board as a leader in diplomacy, as a world leader. And you're not going to be those things if you're led around the world by the nose by a Saudi feudal prince. That's got to change. Didn't change under Trump. Didn't change under Obama. I hope to see Biden change that.
The new U.S. administration has made some policy changes regarding Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden has ended American support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and has freezed the sales of weapons to the kingdom. These are not looking very bright for the relationship between the two allies, at least for now. The release of the report on the assassination of Khashoggi is expected to further strain the ties between the two sides. However, during a call with the Saudi king on Thursday, Biden told Salman that he would work for bilateral ties as strongly and transparently as possible. Biden and top administration officials have stressed that they are committed to Saudi Arabia's security. Biden has been in office for a little more than a month, and it is definitely too soon to judge his decisions. The Saudi kingdom is right now a major foreign policy dilemma for the White House. Even if Biden is willing to punish the Saudis for their rights violations and destabilizing actions like their war in Yemen, the road ahead for him will be very bumpy. This is because the kingdom is a long-standing U.S. ally with many powerful friends in Washington. Meanwhile, Saudi petrodollars will definitely not be easy for the Americans to resist.
On September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown into the twin World Trade Center buildings, killing almost 3,000 people. Soon after, then-President George W. Bush announced that time has come for the world to come together and fight a war against all those who seek to export terror. That announcement gave birth to the first war of the 21st century, the so-called War on Terror. 20 years after the invasion of Afghanistan by the U.S.-led forces, the U.S. counterterrorism operations have only expanded. A recent report published by the Costs of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute and USA Today shows that despite the talk of refocusing on great power competition, counterterrorism policy of Washington has not changed. According to the report, the U.S. military has been in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. U.S. troops have conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Washington also owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That's while China, as the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. Another report by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, revealed that the U.S. spent over $732 billion on national defense in 2019. That was more than the next 10 countries combined. The forever war has lasted for two decades, to the tune of $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington to reassess its policies, as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs. The ongoing war has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and nearly 336,000 civilians have lost their lives, while only 260,000 enemy fighters have been killed. Some estimates put the total number of people killed as a result of the war on terror at around 2 million.
The U.S. has nothing positive to show for this two decades of terror and violence around the globe. What it does have to show for it is increased hostility toward the United States everywhere, which of course justifies, in the minds of U.S. government officials, the purchase of more military equipment and more interference.
Back in 2019, during a foreign policy speech, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden urged the ending of forever wars, saying that it has cost dearly for the U.S. However, Biden is linked to people who have strong ties to the military industry that is driving this war. Over 8 out of 23 picks for the Department of Defense Agency Review team by Biden were linked to organizations, think tanks, or companies which were directly funded by the weapons industry or were part of it. Interestingly, 3 of those 8 were employed in the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which receives funding from Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics, as well as other weapons manufacturers and oil companies. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and General Dynamics account for over 50% of the industry's lobbying. Defense companies spend millions every year lobbying politicians and donating their campaigns. That will ease the way for them to sell their missiles and guns and other equipment to countries around the world. Just 200 defense companies reported lobbying the federal government in the year 2020.
We definitely are. These are people who think war is the way of resolving any perceived problem that the United States has with any other nation. Diplomacy is not something that they have any respect or regard for whatsoever. This is proven in the various ways they have dealt with the situation throughout their careers.
The post-9/11 wars seem to be endless, and the latest figures and statistics approve that notion. Despite President Joe Biden's claims of ending the war, it seems the gulf between his words and reality is too wide. While defense contractors lobby for selling their arms and weapon industry lobbyists become Joe Biden advisors, isn't Biden administration then a war administration?
On Thursday, the United States carried out airstrikes against facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the raid authorized by Biden had been, quote, deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and Iraq. The military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and missions in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on so-called Iran-backed Iraqi resistance groups. In the latest such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy and other missions, on Monday. The American military base at the Erbil International Airport had similarly been attacked days earlier. The Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have, however, roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements. Pro-Western media outlets describe the U.S. air raid on the Iraq-Syria border as a signal to Iran, which they claim is using Iraq's PMU as a, quote, proxy force in the neighboring country, allegations that Tehran has categorically denied.
Joe Biden is a neocon. He has surrounded himself in his foreign policy, his national security advisor, secretary of state, ambassador to the United Nations, the Pentagon. He has surrounded himself with the same cast of characters to a very large degree, who took care of foreign policy during both the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. This is a very aggressive group.
Damascus has slammed the U.S. air raid as a cowardly act of aggression, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of the new president, Joe Biden. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, also condemned the U.S. attack as a continuation of raids carried out by Israel on Syria in violation of international law. U.S. President Joe Biden's order to attack the Iraqi anti-terrorism groups on the border with Syria has been criticized both at home and abroad. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said on Friday that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the PMU facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time. The Russian Foreign Minister said the U.S. military is present on the Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on the reconciliation in the Syrian Arab Republic. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the U.S. is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the U.S. air raid, warning against any action that further complicates the situation in the crisis-hit Syria. Also, a number of Democratic U.S. lawmakers have found faults with the legal justifications of President Joe Biden's administration for the airstrikes, demanding that the officials at the White House immediately brief Congress on the matter. Many expected the Biden era to mark a departure from the damaging and warmongering approach of the Trump administration. It now appears that Biden is following the footsteps of the former president.
Really, Joe Biden has a career as a neocon. He supported the Iraq war and the invasion and occupation of Iraq when he was in the Senate and in a very influential position as the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As the vice president, he was personally tasked with dealing with the coup in Ukraine and the overthrow of the government, the constitution of a new government that would meet the needs or demands of Washington. And we could go on and on. I mean, going back to wars in Central America in the 1980s, Trump, when some of the liberals who follow and support Biden said when Trump fired the missiles, ordered the missiles fired into Syria early in his presidency, they declared that's what made him presidential. So I guess, you know, we have to take it that making war is what makes a U.S. president a real president.
Biden authorized the attack in another sovereign state in his second month in office. Does he really have a change in the U.S. foreign policy in mind? Or are there more conflicts to come?
Limelight. Trump has been unusually quiet about his future plans, but sources close to the former president say that in his upcoming speech at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference in Florida, he will attempt to brand himself as both the current leader of the GOP as well as the presumptive nominee for 2024 presidential election, says Chris Walker, writer in an article published under the heading, Romney says Trump will be GOP nominee if he runs in 2024. Here's more. Speaking about the future of the Republican Party on Tuesday, February 23rd, Senator Mitt Romney said it's very likely that former President Donald Trump would win the nomination for president if he decided to run again in 2024. I don't know if he will run in 2024 or not, but if he does, I'm pretty sure he will win the nomination, Romney said in an interview with the New York Times. Romney also acknowledged that a lot can happen between now and 2024, but stuck to his prediction that Trump would be the nominee if he chose to run. He cited polling data for the reason he held to this belief, noting that Trump was far beyond where any other potential candidate was at in terms of preferences for the next presidential election. A look at the polls and the polls show that among the names being floated as potential contenders in 2024, if you put President Trump in there among Republicans, he wins in a landslide, Romney said. Polling does indeed show Trump ahead of the rest of the GOP pack of potential candidates. When Republican voters were asked who they preferred among a list of names, including Romney's, for the 2024 nomination, most of those surveyed showed a clear preference for the former president. Romney garnered 4% support in a recent Political Morning Consult poll from earlier this month, while fellow Senator Ted Cruz received about 3%. Former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley garnered 6% and former Vice President Mike Pence received 12% of backing from those taking part in the poll. Trump outdid them all, receiving 54% support from Republican respondents to run for president in 2024. Some have suggested, however, that Trump should not set his eyes solely on the White House. Speaking to a group of Republicans earlier this month, Steve Bannon, who was briefly the chief strategist to Trump during the first year of his presidency, said Trump should also consider a congressional run between now and 2024. If Republicans won the House in 2022, Bannon said, and if Trump was among those who ran and won, he could convince the GOP caucus to let him become Speaker of the House as well, ousting current Speaker Nancy Pelosi from the position. Trump could then run for president 2 years later if he still wanted to do so. Trump is a disruptor. But he has a long-term vision because I absolutely believe in the marrow of my bones that he will be the nominee in 2024, Bannon explained. He will come back to us, we will have a sweeping victory in 2022, and he will lead us in 2024. Bannon also attempted to feed into the big lie being perpetuated by Trump loyalists of Biden being an illegitimate winner in 2020 due to election fraud. A claim that has absolutely no basis in reality, they said. As a Speaker of the House, Trump could in theory try to rectify what supposedly happened to him, Bannon noted. The first act of President Trump as a Speaker of the House will be to impeach Joe Biden for his illegitimate activities of stealing the presidency, the former advisor said. Trump has been unusually quiet about his future plans, but sources close to the former president say that in his upcoming speech at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference in Florida, he will attempt to brand himself as both the current leader of the GOP as well as the presumptive nominee for 2024 presidential election. Some of those sources have also said Trump is planning to be a kingmaker in 2022 midterm elections, supporting candidates that are loyal to him while attempting to oust those in the party who weren't always on his side when he was in office. He will undoubtedly get a lot of support from Republican voters no matter what route he takes. But while polling data does show Trump has a strong chance to woo over Republicans in the next presidential primary process, Americans overall are not happy with the idea with 54% of voters from all political leanings saying they'd rather he remove himself from politics entirely versus remain in GOP politics, according to a recent CNBC All-America Economic Survey published in February.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
This type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters all around the globe, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program in IRIB English Radio. The program's name is For Humanity. And I'm Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and we will talk about in this program about the treatise on rights, and specifically about one specific right, which is the right of the one who takes advice. Haqqul Mustashir in Arabic. Haqqul Mustashir, the right of the one who takes advice. In other words, the right of him who asks you for advice. And in the previous program, we talked about the art of giving advice. And inshallah ta'ala, I will continue the same way in this program. We went through 5 different tips of 17. And I will mention the 5 for the new listeners. Number 1, examine your motives, your intention when you give advice to someone. Number 2, be sensitive about how to bring up the subject. Number 3, avoid giving advice in the form of reprimand or belittling the person. And number 4, keep privacy. Giving advice in Islam should not involve exposing or exploring the privacy and personal weaknesses of people. And number 5 was ask permission. Always be humble and always ask if your advice is desired, and that shows respect for others and prevents resentment. And inshallah ta'ala, we'll continue now with the other tips of how to give advice and the art of giving advice. Number 6, listen first. While this rule applies to all good communication, it becomes very important when we wish to give advice. Issues are often more complex than they initially appear. By listening first, we open a space for the speaker to more fully describe the situation for us, to more fully understand it. What is the point of offering advice based on partial information? In addition to this, when we listen first, it makes it more likely that the other person will then listen to what we have to say. One needs connection before correction. I will say it again. One needs connection before correction. It is empathic listening that establishes the connection. Number 7, consider the other's frame of mind. Moments of emotional upheaval are not conducive to giving advice. Always state the positive first and the negative last. This will make the other person relax and welcome your advice. We will go for a short break, dear listeners, and please join us after the break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio and the program for humanity. We're talking about one of the rights in the Treatise of Rights of Imam Sajjad, Imam Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, which was the right of him who asks you for advice. And we reached a couple of tips now. Tip number 8, which says, offer advice without insisting. Offer your insights, your experiences, your ideas, as if they were another point of view, and trust the listener's inner wisdom to decide what is right for him or her. By not insisting, you increase the chances for your words to be considered. Number 9, avoid making judgments. Avoid being judgmental. Do not attack the other party's character. An advice that is perceived as being harsh or judgmental is likely to offend the person hearing. Number 10, avoid threatening. Do not make threats or scare someone by turning advice or criticism into veiled ultimatums. Such display are unlikely to produce positive results. 11, be specific and brief. If you have been asked for your advice on a particular problem, focus on the issue you are being asked about and do not make comments about other areas of that person's life. Also, try to make your advice short and to the point. Number 12, avoid compelling others to follow your advice. It is obligatory on the advisor to render sincere advice to others, but it is not his right to compel others to follow his advice. One should not give advice on the condition that it must be accepted, dear brothers and sisters. If one goes beyond this, he will be oppressing others, not advising, thus seeking obedience and control, which is completely wrong. Number 13, give advice as an act of worship to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, not as a habit. For some people, giving advice turns into a habitual pattern. Sometimes one gives advice to others to avoid dealing with one's own problems. He who is preoccupied with telling others to be good may find no time to be good himself. Number 14, show some humility. One of the ways to do this is to make it clear that you are willing to ask for and receive advice yourself. You are not Mr. Perfect. If you are able to establish this fact for the person you're advising, then that person will automatically feel that you are on the same level and would accept from you what you have to say. That's all for today, dear brothers and sisters. I hope that you like the advices and the tips, and we will continue, inshallah ta'ala, with the other tips that we did not go through in this program and future programs. You can contact us through our email address, which is englishradio@irib.ir, and you can listen to us in parstoday.com. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
In the Limelight.
A United Nations report reveals just how far off the world is from meeting the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement based on the emissions reduction plans that governments across the globe have put forth for the next decade. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, A Red Alert for Our Planet. New UN report shows radically bolder action needed to hit 1.5 degrees Celsius target. Here's more. A United Nations report reveals just how far off the world is from meeting the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement based on the emissions reduction plans that governments across the globe have put forth for the next decade. The Paris Agreement aims to limit global temperature rise this century to well below 2 degrees Celsius, and preferably 1.5 degrees Celsius compared with pre-industrial levels. Scientists warn accomplishing its more ambitious target requires cutting planet heating emissions 45% by 2030 from 2010 levels. The new report from UN Climate Change shows that if recent pledges were implemented, emissions would only drop 1%. The initial NDC synthesis report focuses on nationally determined contributions, NDCs, that parties to the agreement have released ahead of COP26, a summit in Glasgow now scheduled for November